Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Hello, I'm Andrew McDermott. Today I'm speaking with Paul Nelson, a senior fellow of the Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture, an adjunct faculty in the Master of Arts program in Science and Religion at Biola University. Nelson is a philosopher of biology who has been involved in the intelligent design debate internationally for 3 decades. Paul, great to have you with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, all the way back in 1835, Charles Darwin got to go on the trip of a lifetime. During the 5-year voyage, his boat was docked in the Galapagos for 5 weeks. Indeed, about a quarter of Darwin's notes and field book are dedicated to this spectacular location. Years later, he'd write, "Considering the small size of these islands, we feel the more astonished at the number of their aboriginal beings and at their confined range. Hence, both in space and time, we seem to be brought somewhere near to that great fact, that mystery of mysteries, the appearance of the new beings on this earth." So, Paul, you recently got to travel to the Galapagos Islands. Can you tell us a bit of the backstory of this trip?
Sure. It's actually kind of humorous. I don't know about the listeners, but for me, every birthday with a zero in the number is intimidating. So 20, 30, 40, those zero-containing birthdays always shook me up. And I was facing the big 6-0. Yeah, I'm old. I wrote my senior thesis in college on a funny, noisy old machine called a typewriter, which is now an antique, and probably many listeners have actually never used one. So anyway, I was facing the big 6-0. And my wife, Suzanne, knew this. And of course, she also knows that I've always wanted to visit the Galapagos Islands, which, you know, your quote from Darwin indicates, for any biologist or student of biology like me, the Galapagos is a place akin to a scientific mecca, right? So Suzanne, you know, she's very clever. She loves a good surprise. She arranged a birthday surprise for me, which she revealed at one of the best restaurants in Chicago. It's called North Pond, like a Michelin 3-star location. And at that meal with my daughters and my brother Joel and his wife, she said, "Guess where we're going? We're going with the National Geographic Organization to the Galapagos." So I was thrilled. It really was a once-in-a-lifetime event.
Wow, that's awesome. What a great surprise.
It was. I was stunned. I had no clue. I mean, she really knows how to roll out a surprise.
So tell me, what were the ship and the group you traveled with like?
So we were aboard the National Geographic Lindblad ship called the Islander. It's a twin-hull catamaran, not a very big boat, only 48 passengers and about the same number of crew. So we got to know everyone on board and, in fact, most of the crew. We sailed from a small island called Baltra, which is flat, so one of the Galapagos airports is there. And typically people fly in from the Ecuadorian coastal city of Guayaquil. So the Islander follows, at least on the trip that we were taking, a largely east-west circuit. If you look at a map of the Galapagos, the archipelago favors taking either an east-west or a north-south circuit around the islands. So we had one lead naturalist, an American who spent most of her career in the Galapagos. Her name was Lynn Fowler, and I'll say more about her in a minute, and 3 Ecuadorian national park rangers, one of whom was named Lenin, actually, after the Russian Revolutionary. Huh. Not a name you hear a lot in the States. His parents were very enamored of the Russian Revolution. And each of them led a smaller group of about 15 people. So the Ecuadorian park rules dictate that groups growing ashore be no larger than 15. So each of our groups had its own naturalist.
Okay. Well, tell me about the naturalist you were with, Lynn Fowler.
She is an amazing woman. Really astonishing. I think she's in her early 70s now, although she has the energy of a much younger person. She's the niece of the late Jim Fowler, who was a famous zoologist who died last year at the age of 87. Probably some of the older listeners will remember Jim Fowler from his frequent appearances on The Tonight Show, where he would bring exotic animals for Johnny Carson to interact with.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's amazing. Now, Lynn grew up with giraffes and zebras and a hawk and other exotic animals on their family farm, of course, interacting with her famous uncle, Jim Fowler. And she ended up doing her PhD at the University of Florida studying Galapagos tortoises. So that's how she came to be on the Galapagos. And to do that, to gather the data for her PhD, she lived entirely alone on the rim of an extinct volcano on the island of Isabella. She was there for 18 months, and this is in the 70s, so no GPS, no cell phones, not even any fresh water, except what she brought in herself or was able to collect from dew and rainwater in tarps. And actually, she told us this, and we had to laugh. Much of the time, she walked around by herself entirely naked.
Wow.
Yeah, she said, you know, why bother getting dressed if I'm the only human being around? Me and thousands of tortoises, right? And you have to admit, there's a certain logic to that. Why bother with clothing? So I found her just a remarkable fund of information during the trip.
She sounds like a lifelong student of nature. So how did she get along with an intelligent design proponent then?
Well, I actually kept that very much in the background because I wanted to learn whatever I could from her. Unfortunately, I have found over the years that when people learn that I'm an intelligent design proponent, it can cause a negative reaction.
Yeah.
And I would prefer for them to get to know me first and see that I love biology. I love science. I'm not someone they need to fear. So during the course of the trip, I really just wanted to interact with her on the basis of evolutionary theory, which of course she knows quite well, and learn as much as I could from her about the local zoology of the islands.
Yeah. Well, that sounds like the perfect approach. You know, go as the individual before you introduce the group you're associated with.
You don't want to scare people unnecessarily.
Yeah, for sure. Well, take us to the Galapagos. Give us a few details that help us see and hear and even taste it. What were your impressions of these islands?
I have to say I went in skeptical because one of the members of my dissertation committee, Bob Richards, who's a historian of biology, had told me years ago, he said, oh, they're rocky and hot and there's not a lot to see, right? So Bob and some other people who had been there said, well, you know, they're sort of overrated. On the other side, my daughter Olivia, who had spent several months in Ecuador and went out to the Galapagos, she raved about them. So I'm trying to balance these two conflicting opinions about the islands. And I went in somewhat skeptical. I think, yeah, it's really not going to live up to the hype, right? Well, it did. I was really impressed. In fact, at a very, very deep level. First of all, the uniqueness of the fauna, the animals. You had flightless cormorants, the northernmost population of penguins on Earth. You know, globally, most penguins inhabit regions below the Tropic of Capricorn. And here we're going swimming and penguins are shooting by us. We're snorkeling and penguins are zipping right by us. They're amazing swimmers. Giant tortoises, of course, the famous Galapagos tortoises, blue-footed boobies, these very, really almost comical birds with their elaborate mating dance, where the male is showing off these aqua blue feet that he has to the female, and she's sort of inspecting them like, well, I guess you'll do, you know, and he's saying, look at these, look at these beautiful blue feet that I have. Tell me I'm not going to make a wonderful mate. Marine iguanas. Only here, nowhere else in the world, do you have these big charcoal-colored iguanas that, you know, go into the water and eat the algae on the rock surface below the water, come out to warm themselves up, and then go back in again. It's really like no place on Earth. So in that sense, the islands more than lived up to their reputation as a biological mecca. But I have to tell you the thing that most struck me was how tame the animals were. So here in Chicago, if I go out for an early morning run in the Forest Preserve, which is a few miles from my home, the Cook County Forest Preserve runs like a green beltway all around Chicago. The deer that I see are the coyotes. And actually, it's remarkable. We have a lot of coyotes here in the city of Chicago and in Cook County. They give me plenty of room. They are not interested in interacting with me at all. The same with birds, raccoons, skunks, foxes. In general, the wildlife here avoids human contact if at all possible, right? They give us plenty of room. They're, unfortunately, from a biological perspective, they're fearful of human beings.
Yeah.
On the Galapagos, one day, I think it was on Isabella, I was standing a few feet from a pair of blue-footed boobies in the midst of their mating dance, and the birds were totally indifferent to me and the other people in our group. We could have been boulders on the hillside as far as these birds were concerned. Now, if it wasn't a violation of the park rules and also, you know, wildly irresponsible biology, we could have reached out and touched them. Yeah. The general rule there is give the animals a 6-foot buffer zone, but that's really for the sake of the animals, right? A human being who was irresponsible could actually reach out and touch them if he or she wanted to. Charles Darwin was deeply impressed by this on the Beagle Voyage. So in chapter 17 of The Voyage of the Beagle, which is the book that first made his scientific reputation, he noted what he called the extreme tameness of the birds, for instance, in the archipelago. So let me just read you a short quote here from The Voyage of the Beagle. He said, "A gun is here almost superfluous, for with the muzzle, I pushed a hawk off the branch of a tree." Right? So you can, I'll say parenthetically, you can imagine him holding a shotgun and he reaches up and just nudges a hawk off a branch. The hawk isn't even going to fly away. He goes on, "One day while lying down, a mocking thrush alighted on the edge of a pitcher made of the shell of a tortoise, which I held in my hand and began very quietly to sip the water. It allowed me to lift it from the ground while seated on the vessel." So the bird's drinking water out of this pitcher that Darwin is holding and not bothered at all. So he concludes, "It would appear that the birds of this archipelago, not having as yet learnt that man is a more dangerous animal, disregard him in the same manner as in England, shy birds such as magpies disregard the cows and horses grazing in our fields." What's amazing to me is that, and I'm sorry for all these superlatives, these adjectives I'm throwing out, but they really do apply, that almost 200 years after Darwin was there, this fact about Galapagos animals, the fauna, that they're tame, is still the case. And I think we owe the Ecuadorian government and the Park Service a debt of gratitude, and also globally the biologists who have worked to preserve those islands, because you get off a little Zodiac inflatable and walk up, and you can see the sea lions are there, and they don't care that you're there. The marine iguanas, you could practically walk across their backs if you were irresponsible. They are so tame, it stimulates your imagination to say, what explains this? So that's what struck me. And, you know, there's a difference there. Why do the birds in my own backyard take off as soon as I go out to fill up their bird feeders? Whereas on the Galapagos, they just don't care.
Yeah.
And we have to explain that. We've got to give an account of why this difference exists. And it turns out to be history. History in a way that, I'll be deliberately provocative here, Darwin was right. Living things have histories, and we need to take those histories into account when we come to explain why they are the way they are when we find them.
Sure. Wow. Well, I'm sure you had a lot of impressions, and some obviously, you know, touching on the differences with evolution and ID, and we can get into that. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have for now. But listeners, don't worry. Paul has more to share with us about this trip in two upcoming episodes, so we can look for those. Paul, will you come back and share some more?
Oh, yeah, I definitely will.
Well, you can catch more episodes in this series and other great content at idthefuture.com or via your favorite podcasts app. For now, for ID the Future, I'm Andrew McDermott. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.